Brent Decker, who works with Cure Violence International Partnership Coordinator, as a coordinator, and has been with this organization for over a decade, so you've cast your seven-year itch with them. And he's worked with a wide range of partners to adapt, train, and provide ongoing technical assistance and on the implementation of the model in the U.S. and internationally. And some of the areas where he's worked have included Chicago, Baltimore, New York, New Orleans, where we're going to be next year, Philadelphia, Kansas City, Honduras, Iraq, Trinidad, Tobago, South Africa, Kenya, and England. And he has an MPH in international health, and he's going to be joined at some point by his colleague, Jason Featherstone, but the floor is all yours.
Okay, great.
And you have 15 minutes.
15 minutes.
Yeah.
All right. Good morning, everyone. So what we're gonna talk about today is implementing the Cure Violence model in kind of an international or different context. I don't know if anyone had an opportunity to see Dr. Slutkin speak on Monday. Anyone? Yeah, and so we're not going to spend too much time going through some of the theoretical stuff behind it because we want to talk about how we adapted to different contexts and using the London prison system as the example. So my partner here, Jason Featherstone, wherever we work, any country, any city, we always work with either local non-governmental organizations or governmental organizations. So he was going to be in town, and so I wanted to at least have half the presentation just come from the person who's been implementing it instead of me. So we have no disclosures I'm not even to make. In terms of getting started, I think more and more violence has been recognized as a public health issue. And so for us, I mean, a lot of times when we're presenting this, that's like the first like 20 minutes of explaining it. But I think at APHA we can kind of move to explain what public health is. We don't have to cover it as much. But in terms of how our approach is with dealing with any epidemic, there's kind of three main parts of it, right? So it's the interrupting transmission, the behavior change with the highest risk, and changing community norms. And so the way that we do this is by working with those who are most closely associated with the problem. So our focus, wherever we're working, be it Chicago or Iraq, are individuals who are currently involved in violence, working in the communities where there's the highest levels of violence, and then focusing on behavior change, and then always using data and research to kind of to influence or inform how our program works. And to just give you a sense of how that looks in terms of the first thing of interrupt transmission, in areas we work, we have kind of a new category of worker called a violence interrupter. Some of you might have seen the film on Frontline called The Interrupters, and that basically tells the story of three of our workers and some others. But their job is basically to identify and detect when conflicts are going to take place. And the way that they're able to do that is our workers always come from the communities where the violence is taking place. They always come from the groups or gangs or crews that are associated with that violence. So the way that they hear about things is on a different level of access than, say, a police officer or a social worker or even a teacher. I mean, they're many times from the same groups or organizations, and they have their ears to the ground in a way that nobody else does. And so their job is really to listen to the streets or wherever they are to see what conflicts are brewing, and that same ability they have to hear about the conflicts they use to have the credibility to be able to interrupt the transmission by mediating conflicts, either before they happen or preventing retaliation once they do. And so we've kind of two categories of workers, but that's one set of the job. The second part is they work with the high-risk individuals who live in that area as well, kind of on long-term behavior change. So you've got the mediation stuff, but you're also working with individuals who are at high risk to participate in violence to kind of change some of their behaviors associated with the acceptability of using violence to settle disputes, right? And then the third part is working on a more community level in terms of changing some of the social norms around, again, the acceptability of using violence, right? So I have a dispute, be it over you looked at me or you owe me 10 grand, whatever the issue might be, or in Iraq we had a lot of issues having to do with power generators, therefore I must take the second step of violence, trying to bring kind of new ideas and new information about other behaviors that could be take place instead of having to kill or shoot somebody, basically. And so that's what their role is. We've been going since like about 2000. There's been a number of independent evaluations on our programs in Chicago and Baltimore, New York, and it's created a lot of interest, as well as the film, in terms of, in the international community, of like, how can we adapt this model that's had some success in places like Chicago, in Baltimore? What does that mean for a place like Iraq? What does that mean for a place like Colombia? What does that mean for a place like in Honduras? And so we have kind of a whole process in terms of, and I can go back to that slide, but we do have programs, as you can see, running in a pretty wide array of different places. And so for each one of those, it's not as simple as just go, here's the model, go ahead and implement it. There's this whole kind of adaptation process that has to take place in terms of who are going to be the individuals that can identify and detect when the events are going to, violent events are going to take place, and what's going to give them the credibility to be able to do something about it, and what are going to be some of the ways in which we kind of shift the behavior norms around that. And so for any place we work, we kind of go through this process of adaptation. And so the one we're going to talk about right now with Jason is we were originally trying to do stuff on the streets of London in a number of the neighborhoods that had, you know, kind of big increases in violence, but the funding just wasn't there, not surprisingly. And so Jason had already been kind of working in the prison, and, you know, a lot of our work in Chicago and in other places were kind of around that issue. Like, we would go to the prison sometimes or do certain presentations there, but we never had a program inside the prison. And so an opportunity came up to have our actual interrupters be current inmates. So we're actually hiring guys who are currently locked up to serve as these violence interrupters. And so the major adaptations of the model were obviously a different cultural context. It was a country without similar rates of gun violence. Usually when we adapt the model to a place like Honduras, where we're working in San Pedro Sula, it's like way worse than Chicago, you know, and so it was in terms of violent incidents. And so looking at a different country where the violence is much more knives, much more like beatdowns, different types, so it was different in that. It being an actual juvenile institutional setting was very different. We've done some stuff, but we've never had workers who are actually inmates. A close partnership with the institution, and then, like I said, the workers are current inmates. And so I'm going to ask Jason to kind of just give us a sense of like how we were able to do that and look at some of the indicators in terms of where we've had at least initial results. And there's a good study being published by the London Metropolitan University. It's basically done, but it'll be published shortly in terms of the results of the pilot program we've had there in the first couple of months. So I'm going to hand it over to Jason to kind of give a better sense of what it looks like. And then, oh, you got all this. Hold on. Cool. There you go.
Cheers. Thanks, Brent. Hi, morning. All right, so the institution that we're working in is actually called Crookenwood Young Offenders Institute. It houses young people from the ages of 15 to 18. And we were delivering some violent offending behavior work there for about 2 years or so. There was a significant increase in group attacks whereby you had incidents where up to 7 young people were assaulting or fighting one young person. So there was increases of hospitalization of young people, stabbings, broken jaws, internal bleedings, etc. When we started the program in October last year, there were landing conflicts in the prison. You've got different landings, different wings, etc. And there was landing versus landing, wing versus wing, etc. And a number of gang-related issues. So one of the first things we did was to identify what the main causes of violence were in the prison. And we did this by, after we identified the violence interrupters and trained them who they were going to be, through doing one-to-ones with those guys. And you can see, so misinformation and hearsay represent 45% of the violence, so a lot of problems were being caused by Chinese whispers and things that weren't actually true, but the way at the time of dealing with that was violence. Whether it was true or not, it doesn't matter, it's out there, they had to address it. Ratings, which is UK speak for respect issues, representing 30%, so a young person might want to increase his presence in the prison, etc., and they would do that through that. Only 20% of the violence was actually gang or road related, like related to issues of the streets, which was quite surprising. A lot of people think that would have been the primary causes of violence. And debts, like over gambling, etc., was 5%. So some of the new behaviors we worked to establish around these issues, so for example, with the misinformation hearsay, we established that if you heard a rumor, instead of going to act on that information, to go and speak to one of the violence interrupters first and foremost, and they would tell you as it is, whether it was true or not, straight talking, no foolishness, you know. And 9 times out of 10, it was misinformation, so the problems were resolved right there. And what's really interesting, if you look at those first two items, that represents 75% of the violence, which really means it's not real problems. No one's been stabbed or shot over these issues. It's really over foolishness, you know. Okay, so how we identified the initial interrupters, we went and looked at the statistics and identified who were the actual most violent young people in the prison. We did a series of one-to-ones with those guys. And what was really interesting is part of that one-to-one process was, in a time of conflict, who would you be willing to speak to? Not who was your boss who could tell you what to or not to do, but who would you be at least willing to have a conversation with? And they started to give us names. After we went through that process, something really interesting became apparent, that they had identified the 10 most violent people in the prison. They would only deal with each other, if that makes sense. So if you were in there for burglary or theft or anything like that, you were seen as, you're not a serious guy, you know, and for you to come and speak to me about my issues, you're going to be at risk yourself, you know, like, who are you, you know? A quick profile, have a history of violence, non-violence, respected among those who display violent behaviour, and they were, the majority of them were bosses or leaders of their landings or wings. And what we were able to do was to use that current negative influence and turn it around into a positive influence to reduce the violence in the prison. We've done approximately 165 mediations, about 15 a month. We do a short case study. I'll be very quick, got 5 minutes. The very first violence interrupter we worked to recruit. We got him to the table, told him what we wanted to do, etc. And before we got even 5 minutes of conversation, he goes, there's two people we need to get to the table today. And basically, it was two of his friends, and he was close to both of them, but they were in a conflict situation. And the rumour was a hit had been issued, and one of these young people was about to leave into the community the very next day. We did a flash training with him. We were able to get the two young people to a room in separate contexts. About an hour and a half each, we got them to resolve the conflict, and the hit was reversed. Okay, so these are some of the key indicators we were looking at. Overall violence, number of fights, assaults, number of YPs or young people involved, group attacks, assaults, adjudications, which is like the internal prison judicial system, keep apart list. That is a list of young people that aren't allowed to come into contact with each other because there will be violence. And CLR, which represents control and restraint. That's when staff have to get hands on with the young person and restrain them. So if we look at the overall violence, the red dot that you can see in October, here we go, that's where the program was initiated. It took us about 2 months to get traction, and as you can see, we had a quite a good decrease from January. Then something happened in end of March. We had 10 violence interrupters at that time, but in March, 6 were either released or transferred, and we didn't have our eye on that part of the process at that point. We tightened up on that. So we had 4 violence interrupters active. 2 of them got involved in incidents and got placed in the SEG. So we only had 2 violence interrupters that were active. We got on top of that by the end of April and got our figures back up to 10 violence interrupters, and then you can see the decreases, etc., coming forward. Number of fights, I'll just leave these up here for a second. But you can all see in the number of slides that come to April, there's that little spike where we had the 2 VIs active. Number of assaults. Number of young people involved. And group attacks. Now this is very important because this was the reason why we were called into the prison. This is what we focused on. From January to August last year, there were 59 group attacks involving 229 young people. January to August this year, there were 3 group attacks involving 9 young people. It represents a 96% and 95% reduction. So this is the group attacks, and the different colours represent the makeup of the group attack, whether it's a 5-1, 7-1, etc. So you can see that's quite high there. 2013. So that's 2012. That's 2013, 3 involving 9 young people. There was no, the highest amount was a 3-on-1. There was no 4, 5s, or 6s, or 7s on 1s. Brent?
So yeah, just to close up real quick in terms of our implications and next step, we're feeling like pretty confident in terms of the first pilot program that the model could be adapted potentially to juvenile institutional settings to address kind of different issues. Largely, we've done more kind of gun violence stuff. We're interested in doing some follow-up research and firm with the participants after they get released, people who were violence interrupters. There's a potential expansion of the model in the UK for not only juvenile but adult settings, and then I think taking some lesson learned for the implementation there to think about this for other US cities
and in Latin America. So that's kind of where we're going with some of this. In terms of, there's some paper in the back that has some information about cure violence and a link to our website, and so all the kind of studies and things we talked about briefly here is all available for download at the website. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Brent and Jason. That was really nice. We got a double treat because we had two people speaking. This is really nice. And I think one of the things is you really touched on a very important issue. And just today, as we are at the APHA, there were two incidents of gun violence in the past couple of days, one in a New Jersey mall and one in Connecticut. So I think this is something we all really need to pay attention to. And I'm sure you'll have questions after this. And one of the things is, I think this could be easily used in schools too, to see how this can. So I think, you know, congratulations for the work you're doing. And thank you so much for coming across the pond to attend APHA.